I can have your attention while you continue to eat your breakfast, we'll go ahead and get started with our program this morning. We have a number of preliminaries that we need to get covered so that we don't cut into the time available for our speaker. I want to welcome all of you to another meeting of the First Friday Breakfast Club, an association of gay men and by men, and the largest private breakfast club in the state of Iowa. And we have been that for now 22 years. It is our tradition to provide an opportunity at the beginning of our meeting for those who are here for the first time to introduce themselves. It's not a requirement, but if there are those who are here for the first time, would like to be introduced by their host or introduce themselves, now would be the time. Anyone?
Glad to be here, gentlemen.
Welcome. Anyone else?
Don't be shy.
Yes, Scott.
Hey, I'm Scott Hull. I'm the Director of Development for Iowa State Schools. My host, Mark Kurnich, is not here yet, so thank you for having me.
Welcome. Others? Well, those of you who are regulars, if you'll look around and see any unfamiliar faces, be sure to make them feel welcome so that they will join us again. A number of announcements and comments. First, our book exchange back here on the piano, thanks to Scott Kupniel for coordinating that. There are a wonderful variety of books there. Special emphasis on abs, apparently, this month. So for those of you who have that challenge, there you go. Also, there are two copies of Greg McGinnis's book there. And I have now finished Finally Out by Lauren Olson. It's not there in the library yet, but it will be. And it is just really excellent. And there will be a number of quotable quotes in the next issue of the newsletter that I have taken from his book. It's an excellent, really excellent read. Next, you're invited to check out the FFBC website, and that's ffbciowa.org. If you are interested in rehearing one of our speakers, or if you miss a meeting and want to hear the speaker, we do have an audio recording of our speakers on the website. On the registration desk, there is a new member ID, so if you look around the room and you don't see someone you think ought to be here, get us their contact information and we will extend an invitation to them. The board meeting will be next Wednesday, the 11th. It will be at Byron Huff's home. If you need directions, well, I just touch base with Byron. All members are certainly welcome at board meetings if you would like to attend. Our newsletter copy deadline will be 1 week from next Monday, which is the 16th of October. So those of you who are regular contributors, there's your deadline. Any of the rest of you who would like to have an article in the newsletter, if you'll just get it to me by that date, why, we will then get it into the newsletter. Those of you who are reading our newsletter, you will note that we have changed our production editor and changed the format, and I think it's really an interesting look now. So I encourage you to check that out, and we thank Wade Peterson for taking on that responsibility. He has a remarkable talents, and he can turn them around in 24 to 48 hours, so it's really quite remarkable and very refreshing and stress relieving. Next, October the 10th, there's going to be an event at John Schmaker's home, a meet and greet for Austin Frericks. And Austin is running in the primary to run against David Young. And Austin is here, and Austin's going to say a couple of things. Austin. Yeah.
The theme of our campaign is economic concentration. I'm a former economist at the U.S. Department of Treasury, and I think it's one of the biggest issues of our time. To me, the Koch brothers are just modern-day robber barons. We're focusing on the egg mergers right now, but you see in all aspects of your life, two baby formulas behind a lot of the case of Walmart because there's a monopoly. One company has 80% market control. So I was kind of focusing on, we're going to have a great event at John's. I got exciting news I told John the other day is, so we've already got an endorsement of Rokana, the vice chair of the Progressive Caucus. And we just got the endorsement of Alice Waters, the famous chef who started the vegetable garden with Michelle Obama. And then the Sam Cass, he was the Obama chef, and now he's on MSNBC. And he's the executive director of Let's Move. He's endorsed us as well. So yeah, it's kind of exciting. This is, I like to say, I ate a lot of Casey's pizza right now. I'm all over Southwest Iowa. So it's fun. Yeah, I hope to join you guys. We'll have more conversations. Check out our website. We list our platform. I think everyone in the campaign needs to list transition issues. So check it out. All right, thank you.
Thank you. That is on October the 10th at John Schmaker's home, 5:30 to 7:30. The address is 3724 Hunter Avenue, or just ask John and he'll give you directions. Next, we'll come back to you, Scott. Held, if you want to say anything about the Safe Schools event, the flyers are on your table. Scott?
Absolutely. We have the Spirit Awards coming up. It's our annual gala. It's on Friday, October the 20th. If you pick up this beautiful invitation and flip it over, you'll see our keynote, Edie Wong. If you're unfamiliar with Edie Wong, he's a pretty cool dude. He is was a psychologist in Law & Order SVU. He's on Oz, Gotham. So it's a pretty good drop for us. We're really excited to celebrate all the hard work of our staff, our allied businesses, our community coming together and really supporting the kids that we work with every day. It's going to be a great event. The attire is creative black tie optional, so what that means is formal with a whimsical note. It'd be great if you guys could come out and support the kids that we work with and support Iowa State Schools. I know you all have done a great job in the past of doing that, so if you make it to the dinner, that'd be fabulous. There's a link on the bottom of the invitation for tickets. They come to care, so bring a friend. Thank you so
great.
Much.
Thank you very much, Scott. On October the 21st, there is a Progressive Voices event at First Unitarian Church on Bell. It's at 7:30. Tickets in advance are $20, and at the door, $25. It's singer-songwriter Susan Werner. So that is something that you will want to take into your schedule. Next, if you will check out the Primetimers website, they have myriad activities planned every month. There are still 10 activities that they have on their calendar for the remainder of this month. So if you'll go online, you can find Primetimers and a whole lot of things that you would be interested in. Or check with Jim Sturba, who is an FFBC member, and also he is the president. And he's also president of Primetimers. Right over here. Yes. There we go. Next, there's another flyer on your tables about the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus, and Jerry Vreau wants to say a word or two. Jerry.
Good morning. I am Jerry Vreau. I sing with the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus. I'd like to bring your attention to this flyer that's on the desk. It announces our 2017-2018 season, and in here you will find a description of our three concerts. We are already busy getting ready for the December concert. Rehearsals have started. In addition to our concerts, I'd just like to point out that we do other things in the gay community. 2 weeks ago, we were down at Woolley supporting the coronation of the new Emperor and Empress of Iowa. We will see you on Wednesday night at the coming out ceremony at Papa John, or the coming out day at Papa John Sculpture Park. And next week, Saturday, we'll be up in Ames to help the Ames community celebrate what I believe to be their first gay pride celebration. And later that evening, we will be down at the Iowa Leather Weekend singing, as well as backing up the new Miss Iowa Leather in her enthusiastic rendition of I Know Where I've Been. So I would encourage you to look at this, take it home with you, go online, get our season ticket. You save some money when you buy a season ticket rather than individual tickets to my performances. And we would love to look out in the audience and see all of your handsome, smiling faces.
Thank Good. You. Thanks, Jerry. Next, Don Jones is seeking some volunteers for some HIV and activism events between November the 27th and December the 1st. And there is some volunteer training in conjunction with those events on the 27th of November from 4 to 6 o'clock at Des Moines University. The training is really twofold. One is to get some training in talking with someone who is at risk of HIV infection and encouraging them to get tested. And the other is some training in how to break the news to someone whose test has come back positive. So if you're interested in that or would like to get more information about it, Don Jones is sitting right over here and he'd be glad to fill you in on details. And with that, I will turn to Doug Alperl, who is going to introduce our speaker this morning. Doug.
Good morning. I'm thrilled and honored to be able to introduce Reverend Mark Stringer, who became the executive director of the ACLU of Iowa in May 2017, following a 16-year tenure as the senior minister of First Unitarian Church of Des Moines. Now, while this might seem like a radical career shift for him, being a Renaissance man who can professionally reinvent himself is nothing new for Mark, as prior to his call to ministry, his career also often followed widely varied paths, including as a musician and singer, an actor, and even delivering singing telegrams at one point. However, whether previously as a senior minister or now as ACLU executive director, a common thread that has always run through Mark's work is his leadership, advocacy, and passion for building a more just, beloved community and promoting social justice and civil rights in Iowa. While senior minister, he also served as the founding board chair of Project Iowa, a 21st century workforce development initiative of AMIS, which stands for a Mid-Iowa Organizing Strategy. For those who don't know, AMIS is a Central Iowa grassroots community organizing collaborative. And Mark also supported AMIS's work for judicial and mental health reform. As a board member of the Interfaith Alliance of Iowa, including 2 years as its board chair, he promoted the positive healing role of religion in public life, defended the separation of church and state, and advocated for marriage as a civil right for all. Because of his work, the Interfaith Alliance honored him with the Faith and Freedom Award in 2012. His leadership as senior minister was also instrumental in helping his own congregation, First Unitarian Church, increase its already welcoming congregation support of the LGBTQ community and advocacy for LGBTQ rights, become a leader in the Death with Dignity, Aid in Dying movement and support for the terminally ill in Iowa, support the Black Lives Matter movement through serious engagement in white anti-racism work and confronting white privilege, make a commitment to reduce its own contribution to climate change by becoming a green sanctuary, and most recently, to become a sanctuary church to provide refuge for undocumented immigrants threatened with deportation. In 2007, Mark also had the honor of officiating at Iowa's first legally recognized same-sex marriage. Now, Mark mentioned in a recent post that after arriving at his polling place for the recent school board elections, the poll worker told him that even though it was not required yet, he could still show his ID so the poll workers and he could get some practice with that, because it's what you're eventually going to have to do if you want to vote. Mark's reply was, "We'll see about that." So it's my great privilege to introduce to you a man who, as my past minister, has had a profound impact on my life, both spiritually and personally. What kind of impact is he now going to have on the lives of people all across Iowa as the ACLU of Iowa Executive Director? Well, I would say we have only just begun to see about that. But I'm quite confident that, in borrowing the words of another certain well-known national figure, it's going to be huge. Please welcome Reverend Mark Stringer.
Good morning, everyone. It's really good to be here. Thanks to Jonathan for the invitation. Thank you, Doug, for that lovely introduction. I find it hard to believe that it's been about 10 years since the last time I was here. It's kind of shocking how time flies. Back then, I was, of course, as Doug mentioned, I was a few years into my tenure as the senior minister of the First Unitarian Church, and just 2 months earlier, I had that honor and privilege of officiating that wedding, that historic wedding, in my front yard. 10 years ago, to have a gay couple married in Iowa caught many by surprise, even marriage equality supporters, and it was a huge news story. It's kind of shocking now to think about how huge it really was, and because it was such a big story, I was interviewed not just by local press, but by media from all over the country. Me, the minister. Crazy. Still, that day that I got to declare my gospel of marriage equality over and over again to the many reporters who called my home was probably my favorite day as a minister. It was a true blast. I ended every call with reporters the same way. I would say, you know, I've lived in Chicago, I've lived in New York, and it's great to say they need to catch up to Des Moines. Sometimes the reporters laughed, sometimes they didn't. I recall a reporter from the Chicago Tribune said, "Oh yeah, that will happen." For nearly 2 years, the wedding in my front yard of Sean McQuillan and Sean Fritz and Tim McQuillan was the only legally recognized same-sex marriage in Iowa. In April of 2009, as you know, when the court unanimously ruled in favor of marriage equality for same-sex couples in Iowa, I figured that the media attention I had received would ensure a steady stream of requests to officiate same-sex weddings. And I was right. But I didn't know what those opportunities would bring to my life. I didn't know how my time in what I came to call a river of love and justice would change me, but it did. As you can imagine, many of the same-sex weddings I officiated were for couples who had been committed to each other for many years, if not decades. Not only had these couples stood by one another through the ups and downs and uncertainties of life, but as you know, they did so in the midst of a culture that has often sought to delegitimize, if not downright deny, their love. Witnessing the courage and the commitment of these couples made a claim on my mind and my heart, and I committed to share as many of the stories of these couples and love that I encountered along the way, even these many years later. So I'm going to share a few brief stories with you, like the story of two young Iowa women I married who had fallen in love in a small town Iowa high school 5 years before the ruling and who moved to Des Moines to make a life for themselves. On a magnificent early May evening amidst the blooming crabapple trees at a nearby park, I took my place at the gazebo where, once the ceremony began, they would meet me to say their vows. As I waited for their procession, one of the fathers of the brides sought a conversation with me. He had not removed his sunglasses, and I was wondering if he didn't want me to see him cry. I could sense he was a little unsure about his daughter marrying a woman, but he thanked me for being willing to officiate. And then his voice seemed to catch in his throat as he said, "You know, Mark, all parents really want for their children is to be happy." By the time the two women came down the aisle together, big smiles on their faces, lots of family and friends, young and old, basking in the glow of their love for one another, I was the one crying. More than half the same-sex couples I married have raised or still are raising children, of course. The weddings of these couples all included mentions of love and care for their kids, direct opposition to what the religious right would say is some kind of protection of the family. By denying the right to marry to couples. I wish everyone could see the memories that I have of the faces of children beaming with pride and affection at the wedding ceremonies of their parents. I hold in my heart the story of my friends Denny and Patrick, who I married in 2006, but who didn't receive the legal benefits and rights of their marriage until they secured a marriage license the day they became available for everyone. Local television hungry for a story of a same-sex couple getting hitched, met us at the church for a makeshift ceremony, and in the interview that aired that night, Patrick declared to the cameras his delight at being married in the eyes of God and in the eyes of Satan. "You go, Patrick," I yelled at the screen. "Of course God affirmed their wedding, both times. What kind of God would stand in the way of justice and equality?" I think of my longtime Chicago-based friends, two men who have been together for more than two decades now, who shortly after the ruling contacted me and traveled to Iowa so that I could officiate their fourth wedding, as they'd already been married in their home congregation, then in Vermont when their rights became possible there, then in Canada. One of the advantages of not having marriage equality in all 50 states was that some couples got to have lots of weddings. Not really much of an advantage, is it? I remember presiding over the wedding of two women from Kansas, together for 19 years at the time, one of them named Susan, the same name as my wife, while their parents, siblings, and children looked on. The couple recessed to the same song that my wife, Susan, and I chose for our first dance after our wedding, "The Power of Two." If you know that song, it's an Indigo Girls song. The ceremony took 15 minutes, and is the case with most of these weddings, my eyes were tearing up the whole time. This is too close to home, right? To have a woman named Susan going down the aisle to the song that was important. I finally remember the nine couples who traveled to Des Moines with their ministers from Unity Unitarian Church in St. Paul. In a motor coach they labeled the Love Bus. They came to our church for a two-hour ceremony of readings, vows, and tender moments the summer after the ruling. One of these couples would not have joined the bus, they told me, if it had not been for their children demanding that they go. Another couple, both women in their 70s, who had been together for more than 17 years at the time, wore flower garlands in their hair and were quoted by the Des Moines Register saying their wedding was like a dream come true. Volunteers from the congregation, led in large part by Doug, served them like the treasured guests that they were before the happy couples returned to St. Paul that night for a reception at their own church. 8 hours of bus travel for weddings that would not be legally recognized in their home state, and no one seemed to mind, because for a day, at least, these couples were not being treated as second-class citizens. They were treated as though their love matters, because it did, and it does. When church members Walter and David asked me to prepare a homily at the celebration of their wedding a few months after the ruling, I had to ask myself what I could possibly say about marriage to these two friends of mine who everyone present knew had been living as a married couple for 30 years. What am I going to tell them about marriage? The only words I could find were a request that everyone simply reflect on what these two men had been through. How much love they had shared, how many hurdles they had overcome to simply inhabit their loving relationship. And then I thanked them on behalf of everyone present for their example of love and commitment. But what I should have said is, "My friends, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Sorry that it has taken so long for this day. I'm sorry that I did not do more to bring it about sooner, and I'm sorry that I've taken my own marriage for granted for so long." That first fall, I officiated a wedding for a couple who'd been together for two decades. Like many of the same-sex couples I got to marry, they didn't want a traditional ceremony. They just wanted me to say a few words and sign the license. It was about the legal benefits, you know. And they even prepared a script for me, which included a reference to their 20-year-old daughter. I asked, "Why isn't she here?" They said, "She doesn't know about this." I said, "Why not? We don't want her to have to lie to Grandma." These two women had raised a daughter, never fully acknowledging the love that they shared, fearfully never communicating the joy of that love to Grandma, never fully inhabiting their lives. The marriage license I signed for them was from Pottawatomie County, far from Des Moines. When I asked why they didn't get one in our local county, they said they couldn't risk the chance that someone from their work would see the marriage announcement in the paper. Even as I celebrated their marriage with them, my heart ached for all that they could not fully celebrate. A few years into marriage equality, I officiated in my office at the church a tender ceremony for two men who met as actors in a Branson, Missouri Lawrence Welk show. They brought their two daughters with them, 19 months and 2 months. They told me they just stopped having to give the youngest meth 3 times a day. While the eldest daughter ripped up Kleenex at our feet, the two held hands and said their I do's with tears in their eyes. One of the most moving weddings I officiated was for a couple from Florida. The whole planning process took place via phone and email, so when I arrived at the Iowa State House steps one sunny Sunday afternoon, I wasn't sure what to expect. About 30 participants were gathered on one of the landings waiting for my arrival. I met the first groom and looked around for his partner, who was seated on a bench several yards away. As he rose and slowly made his way to the center of the circle with the help of a cane, it was clear that he was living with some kind of degenerative disease that was inhibiting his ability to walk. I wasn't accustomed to having so many people present for a wedding for an out-of-state couple, so when the groom finally made it to the center, I asked the gathering how many were from Iowa. Less than 10 people raised their hands. Most of the people there had flown to Iowa from other places just for this moment. When we got to the declaration of consent, you know, do you take this man to live together in marriage, to love him, comfort him, honor and cherish him in sickness and in health, in sorrow and in joy, from this day forward. Both of these men who were fighting back tears, these men who had been together for 27 years, would not let me finish. Each in his turn interrupted me before I could complete the question with a hearty, I do. They weren't doing it to be funny or to be cute. They were doing it because they didn't want to wait another moment. They'd waited long enough. At the conclusion of the ceremony, I told the men and their friends and families how grateful that I was that they, on behalf of all fair-minded Iowans, that they had come to our state to have their wedding. We hugged and said our goodbyes, and as I started toward my car, one of the men yelled out to me, "Thank you, Mark." And then, almost like a warning, he said, "You know, you were the chosen one." I laughed, I waved goodbye, making my way down the steps, and then he called after me, "I mean it!" I returned to my car, and you'll notice a theme here. I did what I've done after nearly every one of these weddings that I got to do. I shut the car door, I sat there in the silence, away from all the people, and I just would cry. I'd just cry. I cried for joy, really, for these couples and likely people here in the room today, finally being respected and affirmed, not despite their love, but because of it. I cried for the heartbreak that so many have and still will endure just for being who they are. And I cry in grateful response to these precious opportunities I got to have as a UU minister in Iowa to stand in a flowing river of love and commitment, to have my feet firmly planted on the muddy ground of our shared lives as these women and men, some previously unknown to me, some familiar, poured into my life and then passed me, sharing their stories, their love, and their lives, leaving me changed as a result. Now, I know that the evolution toward marriage equality wasn't about me, nor the small role, really, that I played. But I suppose I was chosen, in a way. I was chosen by my willingness to stand in that river of love, to be a witness to these stories, and to continue to pass them on, even these many years later. I was chosen to lovingly and compassionately remind opponents of marriage equality through the years that these are the lives of our sisters and brothers that we are talking about, our human family we are talking about. This is love we're talking about. Love in a world that needs as much as it can get. So I suppose I was chosen, but all Iowans were, really, whether we wanted the responsibility at the time or not. The whole nation was watching us. including same-sex couples and their families and friends who wanted nothing more than the equality that should have always been theirs. Standing in the current of marriage equality in our state and seeing it flow freely now throughout our country has made me hopeful for other long overdue changes ahead. I know too many of us, it seems like things are hopelessly stopped up right now. But marriage equality in Iowa seemed like a faraway goal just over a decade ago. And look what happened. Which makes me wonder which rivers of love and justice might we yet open up in this nation. Rivers that we may be convincing ourselves right now might never flow. We don't have to be stuck on the shore. We know what it's like to finally move downstream. We can see ourselves as chosen. And we can stand up and speak up when people's rights are denied. We can enter the water now and participate on behalf of justice for all members of our human family. We can stand for the human worth and dignity and rights of immigrants. We can stand for more access to affordable health care for all. We can stand for more income and gender and racial equality. We can stand for sane gun safety laws. We can stand for the world and for all the changes we want to see, not just for future generations, but for ours. I loved my ministry at First Unitarian. I'm incredibly grateful for all that ministry brought to my life. But after 16 years of serving there, I felt a surprising call to move in a new direction, even before I clearly knew what that direction was. I felt called to take all that I had learned as a pastor of a growing, justice-seeking church and apply it to a new career. And when I told people that I was going to leave congregational ministry and they asked what I would do instead, I told them that I thought I would likely manage a nonprofit, because that's really what I'd been doing for 16 years. But to be a good fit, it would have to be an organization working on something I really cared about. An organization, for example, that would fight the death penalty, or seek to end mass incarceration, or work to protect voting rights, or preserve reproductive choice, or promote and defend equality for LGBT folks, or work towards sane approaches to immigration, and so on. Well, lo and behold, last December, just as I was informing the church of my intention to leave in June, I learned of the executive director opening at the ACLU of Iowa. And given that for more than 8 years in Iowa and nearly 100 years nationally, the ACLU has worked on all of these things I cared about and more, the opportunity to me felt like a great fit. And fortunately, the search committee agreed. I began part-time in May as I finished up my contract with the church, and I transitioned to full-time in July. My first day on the job was the day we teamed up with Planned Parenthood Federation of America to challenge in court one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country, the medically unnecessary and frankly insulting 72-hour waiting period and second doctor's visit for a woman to obtain an abortion. We earned a temporary injunction back in May, and have just earlier this week had a request for a permanent injunction denied by a Polk County District Court. So we filed an appeal to the Iowa Supreme Court and are seeking another temporary injunction to protect Iowa women from the law taking effect during the appeal. We are asking the court to protect the rights of Iowa women, especially low-income and rural women, from the significant harm and burdens that will be imposed by this law. And we're hopeful that the court will also see the burdens as violations of women's fundamental rights. But since my first day on the job, the ACLU staff and attorneys and cooperating attorneys have navigated many other challenges. I'll give you a few of them. We have petitioned the Iowa Department of Education to limit the use of seclusion rooms and physical restraints in Iowa schools to last resort measures. We actually have solitary confinement rooms in our public schools. Did you know that? And they're used without always a good reason. You know, maybe a kid's crying too much. Put them in seclusion. It's crazy. I'm telling you, what I've learned in my first few months at the ACLU is so many of the things that we work on are things that would make your head explode if somebody wasn't working on it. For example, we work with the city of Marion to change a city ordinance that prohibited a citizen from simply holding a sign in support of the presidential candidate of his choice while standing on a city sidewalk, just for holding a sign. We defended a teen in Marion County from being charged with child pornography for Snapchatting non-nude photos of herself to a fellow student. We filed a lawsuit against the Department of Corrections on behalf of a transgender client who, while working as a state employee, had been denied use of the men's restrooms and locker rooms and who had been denied equal access to medical care. We've defended the right of a Newton High School student to not be punished for writing and displaying "Love Trumps Hate" on his arm at school. Incidentally, we filed a letter with them the same day, the anniversary, the 48th anniversary of our landmark Tinker versus Des Moines Schools case, a free speech case that really set a precedent throughout the country that free speech rights don't stop at the schoolhouse door. We protected also the free speech rights of citizens of Windsor Heights by challenging censorship by the city of a couple of yard signs critical of recent city government decisions. We've engaged coalition partners to submit joint written comments to clarify the new voter ID legislation and to mitigate any potential harms of it by pursuing an interpretation that does the least harm possible. I've been spending a lot of time reading over all that legislation and the administrative rules about it because I have to like kind of try to explain it in a couple of days. Boy, talk about making your head explode. Talk about an unnecessary, expensive, I almost said something inappropriate. It's a mess. It's a mess. The word I was thinking began with cluster. Anyway. We offered an amicus brief in what turned out to be a landmark ruling in the Iowa Supreme Court against a Muscatine County prosecutor who had sought to use a DACA recipient's continuing employment as a basis for criminal charges. The ruling should help ensure that each Iowa county can't create its own immigration law, which is always a danger. And most recently, we filed a lawsuit to challenge the Iowa Department of Human Services' ban on Medicaid coverage for necessary transition-related surgery for transgender Iowans. Many states have recognized that these bans are not only discriminatory and extremely harmful, but are completely unjustified in light of medical research supporting the need for treatment and the inconsequential cost of adding it. We contend there is simply no justification for continuing this blatant form of discrimination in Iowa or anywhere else. There's so much more that we have in the works, and we stand ready to protect and defend every American's civil liberties and civil rights, even people we don't like, even when it may be unpopular to do so. There's a lot for me to learn in my new role. Can you tell? Wow. But I've got a great team to work with and a wonderful ACLU legacy to build upon, and I'm grateful to lead an organization that puts justice front and center in all that we do. An organization that works on behalf of the rights of all Iowans, all Americans, a nonpartisan organization that, nationally speaking, has grown its membership from 400,000 before the November 2016 elections to more than 1.6 million today. We are nonpartisan, but our current president and his administration presents a clear and present danger to our fundamental rights and liberties. As the ACLU said right after Trump was elected, we'll see you in court, and we have 93 times and counting. To our growth in membership since Trump's election as our Trump bump. I appreciate how one reporter described us in a Vogue magazine feature a while back, not long after I started. It really spoke to me. She wrote, "It's not in spite of the ACLU's stubborn, principled nonpartisanship that people have flocked to it, but because of it. That in this moment, when institutions on both sides of the aisle can seem ineffectual, flimsy, opportunistic, untrustworthy, when faith in the objectivity of even the mainstream media has been shaken, when extreme polarization has made a no man's land of the political center, the ACLU seems to some like true north, among the few groups charting a rational, thoughtful, and unswervingly conscientious course through the snarled, impenetrable briar of partisan politics in 21st century America." So the ACLU has grown a lot in the past year, it's true. But the threats to our rights and liberties are real, and they aren't decreasing. And Americans are looking to organizations that don't just stoke the fear and the injustice, but that seek to heal it and bring about what's fair. Maybe you are too. If so, I encourage you to consider supporting the ACLU of Iowa. I wouldn't be an executive director if I didn't ask you for your money. We rely almost exclusively on financial support from private citizens like you to do our work. I brought contribution envelopes, and Jonathan kindly put them on the table. If you feel inclined to support us today, I can tell you with great confidence after just a few months on the job that your contributions not only matter to us, but they are a great investment in the future of our state as we continue to pursue our current priorities, which include promoting and advancing racial justice, protecting the rights of immigrants, challenging the ever-growing threats to reproductive rights, undoing unnecessary restrictions on voting rights, stopping so-called religious freedom legislation that's really about legalizing and legitimizing unconstitutional discrimination, advancing women's rights, including restoring reasonable protections for pregnant workers in Iowa, something we're going to be working on this session, winning and preserving the rights of our LGBT neighbors, especially those who identify as transgender, as they continue to be targets of hurtful discrimination and unequal treatment. And, of course, defending free speech, a priority that has been foundational for the ACLU throughout its history. As we say, a gift to us today will be the civil liberties victory you read about tomorrow. So thank you in advance for your contributions today and in the future. I enjoyed my 16 years leading First Unitarian, and I'm enthusiastic about what's possible in my new ministry at the ACLU. Because now that I have stood in the river of marriage equality, a river of affection and rejoicing, and have seen the world from the vantage point of justice at last, at least in that area, I want to stand in more. I want to feel the flow of more rights, more justice, more possibility for more people. How about you? Thank you for inviting me to be here today. It's been a pleasure. What happened in Charlottesville is a tragedy. There's no doubt about it. It's a complicated story from the perspective of our ACLU affiliate in Virginia, which stood up. How the ACLU works is that we try to participate in litigation when we think there's a precedent that needs to be set or needs to be stopped. And the precedent that the ACLU affiliate in Virginia was trying to stop was the city taking away a previously granted permit for a protest without ample reason. Public safety was mentioned, but there was no argument presented that suggested they'd actually done their research that this was a problem. Now, in hindsight, it was a disaster what happened. But the precedent that the ACLU was standing up for in that moment was legitimate, because if you don't protect the free speech and right to assembly rights of all, then they can be jeopardized for all as well. So the ACLU of Virginia had actually stood up on behalf of the organizer of this rally before with no impact. I mean, ACLU has to stand up for things we don't believe in. I mean, the ACLU affiliate in Iowa had actually, you know, protected the rights of the Westboro Baptist Church, and we all know those are horrible human beings. But the thing that the ACLU of Iowa affiliate did back then, this is long before I got involved, was that they secured the right to speak out against the Westboro Baptist Church as a part of that agreement, to basically denounce them. And I'm not sure if that arrangement was what happened in Charlottesville, but as you remember, it happened really fast. So that the court thing happened Friday, and then the rally was Saturday. And people on the ground there really claimed that the police did not do a good job of keeping the group separate. I mean, you saw how this could work the very next week, I believe, in Boston, where the two groups were very clearly kept apart. The police, I think, wanted an excuse to shut down the rally, so they made it so that the Klansmen, basically, had to walk through the crowd of counter-protesters to get to the spot where they wanted to be, which basically just created a powder keg. The ACLU spends most of its time protecting and defending the rights of all people, but particularly racial justice, the very things that neo-Nazis are against, we are for. So what happened in Charlottesville should not be seen through the lens of only us protecting the rights of neo-Nazis. It's far from that. But it was certainly a tragedy, and I think it's created some very interesting conversations among ACLU affiliates about how to handle a similar request in the future. I know here in Iowa, we used the opportunity of what happened to really make sure that we secured a couple agreements before we worked with anyone. The ACLU is not obligated to take every case, and we don't. And every affiliate gets to make its own decisions. So I can't really defend Virginia, but it certainly was unfortunate, at the least, what happened.
I was in Denver last year, and there was the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus who were performing at a festival, and the Performing Arts Center downtown Denver. And they have an all-gender restroom, and it's labeled as such. I wondered what the laws in Iowa, if they're moving in that direction, or you know anything about that.
In terms of just
any sex, all gender, a public restroom, all gender.
I can't really speak to that, but it sounds like a good idea to me.
Same at work, all right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, certainly, you know, college campuses have been doing that for a long time in many cases. So it's more prevalent in cities where there's more of a push, I think, in the city government to make that a possibility. I'd like to think that, you know, here in Iowa we could move in that direction, but it is Iowa after all. We have a lot of ground to cover. Thank you, gentlemen.
As you may recall from 10 years ago, it is our tradition to give a token of appreciation to our speakers. This is a recording of the Des Moines Gay Men's Chorus.
Thank you.
If you look and find that this is the same one, you're welcome to re-gift it.
Thank you. I'll keep that in mind. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mark. And on a couple of quick positive notes. The decision of the trial court here most recently that denied the permanent injunction was by Judge Farrell. Judge Farrell is the same judge that ruled against Planned Parenthood in their telemedicine litigation. And it was Judge Farrell in that decision that was reversed by the Iowa Supreme Court unanimously. He didn't even come up with one judge on the Supreme Court of Iowa that thought he hadn't gotten it right in the first instance. So I see that as a very hopeful note. The second I want to relate is a story of a wedding that I was going to, of a cousin of mine and the guy she was going to be marrying. And I drove by the Unitarian Church on my way to their wedding. And outside the church were two women dressed in black tuxedos waiting to go in to get married at the Unitarian Church. I then arrived at the wedding that I was to attend, and he was Scottish and was wearing a kilt. It was just a wonderful day to see him. It was mind-bending and heartwarming. And then just the final comment I would make has to do with a colony of water bugs that lived just off the east coast of Florida. And they were on the surface of the water, and the waves would take them up and down and up and down, and storms would come along and make the waves even more pronounced. And they were constantly debating, are we going up or are we going down? Have we bottomed out or are we about to peak? And through all that debate, and the debate that we have going on right now with our current administration, the water bugs had forgotten about the Gulf Stream, where they were going with England. And what we have seen, in fact, in our movement is where we're going, and we can therefore get through these daily ups and downs. And doing so depends on people like Mark. Thank you very much. I
and we've got lots more to come. In November, we're going to have Dean Lerner here. He is a retired attorney, former assistant AG, and he's going to be talking about assisted elder living. All of us are headed there. And so he's going to give some insights in just how that is being shortchanged in our state, and what little response he's been able to get out of our current sitting senators. In December, we're going to have Reverend Matt Martis LaCroix from the Plymouth Congregational Church. He is an outstanding speaker, presenter, and you will not want to miss. In January, Iowa Senator Matt McCoy is going to be our esteemed speaker, so we have that to look forward to. And then we have, early next year, we're going to have Carol Hunter, who is the publisher of the Des Moines Register. I did their little Des Moines Register-sponsored storytelling thing, so now Carol owes me big. So she's going to be here. Ann Seltzer, the pollster, is going to be an upcoming speaker. And then in deference to one of our members, who wrote in a recent newsletter article their affection for men in uniform, we're going to be having Officer Paul Parizak from the Des Moines Police Department. He's the one who so often is interviewed after a crime or when someone is being investigated. So we will have him to look forward to in the near future. And I look forward to seeing all of you in November. Thanks for being here today.
Picks up everything. So.